Well, I have a couple of handouts for you today. Mr. Schrock and Mr. Johnsy each have a stack of two different handouts. So if you gentlemen would want to go ahead, and I think we have enough. One of the handouts, you can begin. One of the handouts is a listing of phone numbers and addresses for all our members in both Birmingham and Trustville. It's as up-to-date as I know to make it. It's got the most recent information I've been given. And so I want you each to have a copy of that. Of course, I think it goes without saying this is not for general distribution to other than our local congregational membership, but this might help you stay connected just a little bit better. From time to time, if your address or your phone number or your email were to change, please try to remember to keep me posted on that, and I can at least update my files. The other handout that's coming around will relate to the sermon, which we'll get to here in just a moment. But we're going to study a little bit of biblical history today. And so you can just put that aside until a little bit into the sermon, and then we'll go over that. I also want to mention that, I usually like surprises. Most times I like surprises, so we've been planning behind the scenes to have a special guest speaker visiting here in this congregation here in just two or three more weeks, and I had kept it pretty much under wraps because I first wanted to let our Young Men's Speaking Club know about it, because on December, the Sabbath of December, is that the 18th? Be sure I get it right here. Either the 16th or 18th, and I never can remember which it is. Yes, December the 16th. So today being the 25th, that will be three Sabbaths from today. We are going to have our annual end of the year ladies' night for the speaking club, and that will be a very special occasion. And I wanted to have a special guest not only for that, but for the entire weekend. And so that has been arranged, and from our headquarters office, we're going to be visited on that Sabbath, and then again that evening for the ladies' night, we're going to be visited by the Director of Ministerial Services for CAGWA, Mr. Doug Horchek, and his wife, Tanya. And of course, they have been dear friends of my wife and me for many, many years, and we'll look forward to hosting them that weekend. So on that Sabbath, the plans are for Mr. and Mrs. Horchek to accompany my wife and me up to Trenton in the morning, and then they'll be here in the afternoon, and I'm going to put him to work. I said, you'll please give the sermon in both churches, and then that evening, he and his wife will join the club for our ladies' night. So I just wanted to let you know that that's something special to be looking forward to on the Sabbath of December 16th. Now, I know I'm talking to a number of individuals who know their Bibles pretty well, who've been reading their Bibles for many, many years, decades in some cases. And I know you have a lot of background knowledge of the Bible. I'll start out with something I think pretty much everybody in this room has a pretty good knowledge of. I think from our knowledge and our experience of the Bible, most of us in this room probably have a pretty good sense of the life of a man named David. I think just about everybody knows who David was in the Bible. Of course, he was the king of Israel in the past. Some of the historic parts of the Bible talk about his kingship over the nation of Israel in the past. We can read about him in Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. But, you know, in the prophetic parts of the Bible, we see that he was also going to be king of Israel in the future. You don't need to turn there, but there is a verse in the book of the prophet Jeremiah, Jeremiah 30. And verse 9, and if you look at the context of Jeremiah 30, verse 9, it's quite clearly millennial, post-return of Christ. And it has this to say, "They shall serve the eternal their God and David their king, whom I shall raise up for them." Raise up, resurrection. So we know that about David. He was the king of Israel in the past as a human being, and he will be the king over Israel in the world tomorrow, as a spirit, resurrected spirit being. We know that about him. We know another thing I think just about all of us know about David is that he was a physical ancestor of the baby born in Nazareth to Mary and Joseph, the physical ancestor of Jesus of Nazareth. We know that about him. We know that he was a psalm or songwriter. We know that he was a musician and a poet. In fact, in the eulogy given of David in 2 Samuel chapter 23, you might think of it as a eulogy. He is called the sweet songwriter or the sweet psalmist. He wrote beautiful music, sweet psalms, sweet songs, the sweet psalmist of Israel. He wrote many, many of our psalms. So we know that about him. We know that he was a brave and a courageous man, even from from his youth. He was very courageous. He once told the story about how he rescued some of the sheep of his father that he was looking after from a bear, and another time from a lion, and even killed a lion with his bare hand. So he was a courageous young man. And then just a little bit later, he was so courageous, he was the only man in all of Israel who would dare face the Philistine giant Goliath. And of course, we know the story of David Goliath. Just about everybody knows that. 1 Samuel 17 for some of that information. We know he loved God. He was zealous for God, but he also had feet of clay. He was a human being. And he sinned, and sometimes he sinned mightily. And we know that, that his sin of adultery with Bathsheba and then arranging for the murder of her husband to cover for him, Uriah. But he also not only was a great sinner, but he was a great repenter. We read Psalm 51, one of the great songs or prayers of repentance in all the Bible. So these are things about David that I think we're very familiar with. We know something about his descendants, more so one than any of the rest, but most all of us know something about his son Solomon, who succeeded him as the king over Israel. And that was God's choosing. So we know about Solomon, the son of David. But even though we know all of that, there are some other details to David's life that I think we are not as familiar with. Even though we're familiar with all of that and his one son Solomon, we're probably not as familiar with some or all of his other children. And it's about one of his other sons that I want to build this sermon around today, a man named Adonijah. That is spelled A-D-O-N. That's the Adon, A-D-O-N, and then I-J-A-H, I-J-A-H. Adonijah. This is a son of David. Now, he was not the one who succeeded his father over the throne of all 12 tribes of Israel. But he sure wanted to. And not only did Adonijah want to succeed his father, he thought, using human reasoning, we can even see his point, he thought he had every right to succeed his father, David. Using human reason, human tradition, human logic, he had a pretty good case that it ought to be he and not Solomon, his half-brother. And so we're going to look at all of that, the story of Adonijah. There are some very important spiritual lessons. We'll look at a bunch of history, no doubt, but I think there are some definite spiritual lessons that should edify us once we absorb them and inculcate them and believe them about the life of Adonijah. Now, in order to really understand the life of Adonijah, I think we need to spend some time on some background material, not only historical background material, but spiritual background material. And then when we actually are then reading about Adonijah and his story, we'll have a lot more ability to understand what we're reading. If you just looked at the narrative of Adonijah's life, it would be fairly easy to skim over it and just say, well, another failed pretender to the throne, kind of like his brother Absalom. Now, Absalom is another name. When I said another son of David, that might have been the name that came to your mind. Probably most of us are more familiar with that name, Absalom. Well, he was a brother of Adonijah. But in any event, just another pretender to the throne. There's really a lot more to the story than just another one who wanted to be king and wasn't able to be. So I think this background material, which will take us a good bit of time, but I think it will turn out to be fruitful and will help us understand the story of Adonijah even better. All right, now let's back up at arm's length, even from some of what I've said in this introduction. Wanted to be the successor of his father David as king of Israel. Let's back off far enough to say, why did Israel even have a king? Why was there a king David? Why was there any man who was king over Israel? What's that all about? Adonijah wanted to be king over it. Well, why was there any king over Israel? Let's go back and look at the backstory to that. And in order to do that, we got to go all the way back to the time of Moses. Now, this is centuries before we get to David or Solomon or Absalom or Adonijah. It's centuries before. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17. Of course, God is brilliant. I mean, there wouldn't be enough zeros to measure his IQ if it could even be. He's all-powerful, all-wise, all-knowing. Brilliant isn't a good enough word to say to describe it, but he is brilliant. And he made us. He made human beings. He knows how we operate. So God is very knowledgeable of the way the human mind thinks. He knows how the human mind thinks with the influence of God's Spirit, and he knows how the human mind operates without the influence of God's Spirit. He knows his creation. He did create us in the first place. So I think the verses we're going to read here in Deuteronomy 17, clear back in the time of Moses, I think we understand them through that filter or through that lens. God knows his human creation. He knows the tendencies of humans, how humans think, with or without God's Spirit. So he knows pretty much the general trends of human behavior, human motivation, human reasoning, human logic. Let's read this, that God inspired Moses to record hundreds of years before there ever was a king of Israel. Now, in this time, there was Moses, God's anointed prophet and leader, and Aaron, a priest. There was no king. There was no dynastic succession of government. There was dynastic succession of the tribe of Aaron in the high priesthood, but not of civil rulership. God chose Moses. Now, Moses had a couple of sons. We read about him. Not much is said about them. But they did not take over. Somebody with Moses' DNA did not take over when Moses died. Joshua did. God chose Joshua, a person that unrelated to Moses. So there was no dynastic succession. And God was their ruler through his anointed or chosen leaders. But we see this in Deuteronomy 17, beginning in verse 14. It is a prediction, a prophecy, based on God's understanding of his people, what they would eventually end up doing because he knew how they thought. All right, so verse 14 of Deuteronomy 17, when you come to the land, this is long before they were even in the promised land. I mean, they were still in their wilderness wanderings. But he's looking way down into the future. When you come to the land which the eternal your God is giving you, and you possess it, well, that took some more time. They didn't immediately just move in and take over. They were supposed to dispossess all those Canaanite tribes. God told them to. Of course, some people think they're more righteous than God. They don't like that. They don't like the fact that God told his people to dispossess those people that live there. God had his reasons. God should never be judged. It was a righteous thing for God to say, dispossess them and you take over their villages, you take over their houses, get rid of them. Either run them off or kill them. Because we understand they will be resurrected in a much better world. But anyway, but that took some time too. And even then they didn't do it fully. They were told to dispossess them entirely. Of course, they didn't do that. They only went halfway. But a lot of time is going to have to pass. But God looks down through time. So when you come into the land which the eternal your God is giving you, you possess it, you dwell in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. God knew that eventually his people would be tired of being ruled by him. He was their king. He knew eventually they wanted to be like the other nations, which is exactly the opposite of what it should be. God told them to be unlike the other nations, not to pattern themselves after other nations. Other nations were supposed to pattern themselves after Israel when they saw that Israel had this unique relationship with God and the blessings. But he knew his people would tire of having a personal relationship with him and him being their king. He knew this was coming. So he says, at some point you're going to say as a people, I want to have a king. I want to have a human king, like all the nations that are around me. Now, God is just, and he's righteous, and he's brilliant, but he's also merciful and patient. If you can think back to the first time you ever read that verse that I kind of stopped in the middle of, What were you expecting to follow? What words were you expecting before you knew what God said? Were you expecting something like God says, I'm warning you, if the day ever comes that you want a human king, I'm going to wipe you all out. I'm not going to have it. I'm not going to let you have a human king. Maybe you thought that's what the next words out of his mouth would be. Turns out it's not. God is patient. He was patient with Adam and Eve. He said, don't eat that one tree. You'll have a wonderful, blessed life, but don't eat that one tree. And the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Did you expect them to drop dead that moment? He would let them. Why didn't God snatch the apple out of Eve's hand before they took a bite? Why didn't he just intervene so they wouldn't make wrong choices? He didn't do that. That's not the way usually God works. He let Adam and Eve learn the hard way. It's better to obey God than not. So they learned through suffering, through now having land that was cursed and having a death staring them in the face that wouldn't have otherwise been necessary. Well, the same way here. He's going to let Israel learn. It's better to have him as their king than a human being. Doesn't matter how righteous the human being is. God's a lot better king than any human being. But he said, okay, I'll let you learn. If you won't learn because I tell you it's better, I'll let you learn by experience. God often does that. So he says, okay, I'll work with it. It's choice B, which is far worse than choice A, but I'll work with you when that happens. In fact, I'll give you some guidelines to maybe mitigate the curses that will be associated with that bad decision. I'll make it less bad than it otherwise would be. I'll give you some rules about what this king will be like. You shouldn't ask for the king, but if you do, I'll kind of soften the blow of the penalties for you making that bad decision. So he gives some outlines of what this king will be like. He will participate in mitigating how bad it'll be. So he gives some guidelines. Verse 15, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Eternal your God chooses. He says there's going to be two conditions. I will choose the king. You don't elect him, I'll choose him. If you insist on not having me as your king, I'll let you have a human king, but I will choose him. You don't get to choose him yourself. And then secondly, from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. You cannot have a Gentile ruler. Israel should not have a Gentile ruler. Israel should have an Israelite ruler, a native-born Israelite. Now, that's a principle that God set way back in those days. It's an eternal principle. And without going into a lot of detail, just think in our recent history, descendants of Israel, what's happened in recent years and decades in this country. If you're going to have a human ruler, it's got to be an Israelite. And I choose him. Verse 8:16, he said, I'm going to put some rules here that should be followed. He shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Eternal has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives. Now, I already introduced the concept of David centuries later. Even righteous David did not obey this. A king over Israel should have one wife, not multiple wives. But all the nations around Israel, their kings had multiple wives. They had a harem. So Israel's kings had harems. Even righteous David. God did not endorse it. He allowed it. It's a lot better to not have the curses that comes from making ungodly decisions, but sometimes God lets people learn from eating the bitter fruit of their bad decisions. That's just a thing we see about God. Not always is that the way he operates, but often. But here was a rule up front. It was a warning. It was an inherent warning. He should not have a harem. He should not have multiple wives. Lest his heart turn away. Well, isn't that precisely a description of what happened in the case of Solomon? And to what degree it even happened in the life of David, it makes you wonder, based on some things we're going to look at later in this sermon. But we know what happened in Solomon. It explicitly says in the Bible that his many wives turned his heart away from God. So God was warning them of some of the consequences of them making a foolish decision going with plan B, which is not nearly as good as plan A. God's our king. nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Here's a warning. You have human government over you. More and more of your wealth is going to be sucked away from private hands into government control. Well, that's been going on for thousands of years. God knows how humans operate. He knows how human rulers operate, even pretty good ones, let alone bad ones. They shouldn't get rich over government service. They shouldn't become rich as a result of being your human kings or the retinue of the king, the royal household. He says, that's going to happen, though. I'm warning you, and you'll suffer the consequences. More and more through your wealth, more and more of your youth. They're going to leave the family farms, and they're going to go to work for government, in the armies or the service of government. I'm telling you now that you shouldn't. You're going to do it. It's a prophecy and a warning all at the same time. And it's exactly what we read in Kings and Chronicles happen. Lest his heart turn away, nor shall he multiply greatly the amount of silver and gold for himself. Verse 18, it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of the law in a book. Whose law? God's law. From the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him. Now here's another thing. God says this will lessen the damage. It'll lessen the curses on you of insisting on human government to have at least somewhat righteous human government. People that give God's word the time of day. To the degree that your human rulers will read the Bible, will read the laws of God, will at least to some degree pattern their decisions and their behavior after what's in my law, to that degree it'll lessen the penalty. Well, not many of Israel's kings did that one either. Now I say David probably does get a passing mark on that one. But he's supposed to write out a copy of the law by hand, not give it to a secretary and say, run off a Xerox copy of this. Right, that takes a while. It's going to take a while. He's going to be dedicated to a big project, a lengthy project, writing out God's law by hand and then studying it and reading it. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Eternal as God and to be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes. Now, that would make Plan B a whole lot better than it otherwise would be if that part of it was done. That his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. All right, now that's the deep background. There are several takeaway points, but the main two, God says, when you insist on it, at some point I'll give it to you. But I get to choose the king, I will choose the king, and it must be a native Israelite. Well, we fast forward hundreds of years. We go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And we see that prophecy really come to pass. So let's go to 1 Samuel 8. And we see God's involvement. Like he said, he wouldn't just say, okay, you don't want me to be your king, you want me to be a nation. I'll just incinerate all of you. He doesn't do that. He'll still work with them, but not as much as he would have when he was their king directly. So we come to 1 Samuel 8, we begin in verse 1. It came to pass when Samuel, now who's Samuel? Well, he's God's appointed judge and prophet. Samuel wasn't in his position because he was somebody's son. He was there because God chose him. These judges were chosen from different tribes. Each time, God would choose the judge. 1 Samuel 8, verse 1. It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now, we've seen this many times, but God is hard on his heroes. Sometimes it seems like God is harder on the good guys in the Bible or as hard as the bad guys. Here is righteous Samuel, a man I fully expect will be in the first resurrection, a great prophet and judge that God appointed, but he's making a mistake here. He doesn't have the right to appoint his own sons, judges, to succeed him. God would do that as well. And these aren't very good sons. Samuel's a good judge, a righteous judge, but not his sons. So even here we see a mistake. He doesn't really have this right unless God had explicitly given it to him. Said he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel. The name of his second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They weren't nearly as close to God as their father. They were corrupt. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes, perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, as God knew eventually they would, and they said, "That's it. We're tired of living under this system. In our own mind, we're fully justified in making this request. In fact, this demand." In their minds, they were fully justified in this. "We're going to throw out this whole system. We want a king. We want a king." They came together to Sammy at Ramah and they said, "Look, you are old. We don't mind you as our judge, but these sons of yours are corrupt and we're not going to have it. Your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make for us a king to judge us like all the nations." Exactly what God had predicted hundreds of years before would happen. And God is going to tolerate it. But he's going to give some warnings along the way. This is plan B. It's not nearly as good as plan A. I'll work with you in it, but it's not going to be nearly as good as plan A. But the thing displeased Samuel. Samuel wasn't happy about this at all because he took it personally. The thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed about it. He prayed to the Lord. And the Eternal said to Samuel, "Let him have it. Go ahead. We'll let him have it. I'll let him have it. Heed the voice of the people in all they say to you. For they've not rejected you." Don't take it personally, Samuel. "They've rejected me." It's finally come to the point where they don't want me to be their only king. "They've not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." Yeah, but God, if you're reigning over us, why would you let these two corrupt sons of Samuel be our new rulers? God says, "If you'll trust me, I'll take care of it. If you'll be patient and trust me and learn the lessons along the way, I'll take care of it." Well, we're tired of letting you take care of it. We're tired of trusting you. So verse 8, "According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day." So here's a little Bible quiz, a one-question quiz. When in Israel's history did they fully obey God? And the answer, never. We just read it. There has been an element of rebellion against God as their king the whole time. He just said it. "Since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, they have forsaken me and served other gods." Here's another one-question test. When in Israel's history did they fully abandon idols? Never. They never fully abandon their idols. They've served other gods. So they're doing to you also. "Now therefore," he tells Samuel, "heed their voice. However, let them know." Let them know how bitter this fruit is they're about to take a bite out of. "You shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." And see if this language sounds familiar. See if it isn't like a second version of what we read back there in Deuteronomy 17. So verse 10, "Samuel told all the words of the Eternal to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, 'This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots.'" The concept of God is every man under his own vine and fig tree, his own few acres of land, growing his own food, trusting God for the necessities of life, and then turning it over to his son or his daughter or his children. And now some of that's going to be interrupted because some of these young men won't be able to take over the family farm. They're going to be conscripted into government service. And oftentimes that'll end up getting them killed in war. "He'll take your sons and appoint them to his own chariots and to be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots." Who's the king's? You want this king so bad? Here's what he's going to do to you. "He will appoint captains over his thousands, over his fifties, set some to plow his ground, reap his harvest, some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields." You know who the biggest landowner in the continental United States is? The federal government. Out west, in the big sky country, all those big states out west, the federal government owns hundreds of thousands of square miles. The federal government owns a lot of that land. Nothing's different over time. "The best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and he'll give them to his servants." And so we see the phenomenon to this day of people going to Washington as congressmen, senators, other officials. They go as thousandaires and they end up, after a number of years, millionaires. How does that happen? Well, it's been happening all the time. You sure? This is your last warning. You sure you want to bite into that apple? He will take a tenth of your grain. I thought we were supposed to tithe to God. Oh, you'll be tithing to the government. Before long, it might be two tithes. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and his servants. So government will swell. More and more of the wealth will go into government. And at some point, you're going to realize you should never have bitten that apple. It's going to be a little bit late at that point. Verse 18, you'll cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Eternal will not hear you in that day. There are some times when there might even be genuine repentance, but the consequences in this lifetime are not taken away. That's one of the great lessons of the Bible. They can be forgiven on an eternal basis, but in this lifetime there are consequences of terrible decisions. Nevertheless, the people refused. They're not listening. Samuel might as well have been in an echo chamber. They were not tuned in to the import of what he was saying. They refused to obey the voice of Samuel. No, you got it all wrong, Samuel. We know what we want. We know what's good for us. We will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations. That language sound familiar? That's exactly what God said through Moses. They're going to want to be like the other nations instead of vice versa. That our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Whatever happened to the idea of God will fight our battles? And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Eternal. Well, God had already heard it. Samuel's utterly frustrated. So verse 22, the Eternal said to Samuel, give them what they want. Heed their voice. Make them a king. I'll tell you who their king will be. I said all along, I'll choose their king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. We'll meet later, and I'll tell you who your king is going to be. God will tell me, and I'll tell you. So we page forward a little bit to chapter 10, and we look at verse 17. Then Samuel called the people together to the Eternal at Mizpah. And he said to the children of Israel, thus says the Eternal God of Israel. And he's going to give them one more history lesson. If that was their last warning, this is their last warning. I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians. Your king didn't. I was your king. You didn't have a human king. No human king brought you out of slavery in Egypt. I did. And from the hand of all the kingdoms and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and tribulations. And you have said to him, no, but set a human king over us, is the implied point there. Set a king over us. Now therefore present yourselves before the Eternal by your tribes and by your clans. Verse 20. And when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, the tribe of Benjamin was taken. Now there's a theme throughout this story of Adonijah. As I said, we've got to get some background before we actually get to Adonijah. One of the themes of the whole story is men's reasoning, men's decisions are often just the opposite of God's. If we're going to have a king, it says in my mind, we ought to have a king from our biggest tribe. We ought to have a king from our most powerful tribe. It ought to be from Ephraim or from Judah. Benjamin? Are you kidding me? That's one of the smallest tribes. Maybe it is the smallest tribe. Who would ever humanly have gone to the smallest tribe? God. There's this background theme. My thoughts are not your thoughts. All right, so Benjamin gets taken as the tribe from which this king will arise. Verse 21, when he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Machri was chosen. And Saul, the son of Kish. Now remember that name Kish. We'll come back to Kish a little bit. That's Saul's father. Saul, the son of Kish, was chosen. But when they sought him, he couldn't be found. He's hiding. At this point in his life, Saul is little in his own eyes. He doesn't want the job. He doesn't feel up to it. That's a good thing. There's not the arrogance in Saul's life now. It arose later. But he's hiding. He doesn't want the job. He's hoping this moment will pass. So verse 22, they inquired of the eternal further. Well, has the man come here yet? This king you're going to appoint, where is he? Do we have to wait for him? And the eternal answered, through Samuel, I'm sure, there he is, hidden among the equipment. You can't hide from God. So he's in hiding, you know. So they ran and they brought him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. He was a big man physically, but he was small in his own eyes. Verse 24, Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Eternal has chosen? That was the part of the deal. You didn't get to vote. God made the decision. And he is one of your brethren. He's one of the tribes of Israel. Do you see him whom the Eternal has chosen? That there is no one like him among all the people? So all the people shouted and said, long live the king. Well, that lasted a little while, but not long. Fast forward a little bit more, chapter 12. Well, we've seen their last warning and their last warning. I guess this must be the last warning, chapter 12. Now Samuel said to all Israel, indeed, I have heeded your voice, because God told him to, in all that you have said to me and have made a king over you. And now here is the king walking before you. And I am old and gray-headed, and look, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my childhood to this day. This last warning is somewhat subtle. God had said, human government is going to steal from you. They're going to get rich at your expense. I guess, the last representative of when God was your king and I was the appointed leader. Did I get rich at your expense? He challenges them. Would he do what the kings would do? Here I am, he said, witness against me. Tell me one time that I did this. Witness against me before the Eternal, before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? God said, the kings are going to take your oxen and your livestock and your sons and daughters. Did I do that, Samuel said? Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I received any bribe which to blind my eyes? I'll give it back to you right now in front of everybody here. I won't even deny the charges. He left them speechless. Samuel had not done that. And they admitted it. They said, you have not defrauded us or oppressed us, nor have any taken anything from any man's hand. Then he said to them, the Eternal is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. And they said, he is witness. And Samuel said to the people, it is the Eternal who raised up Moses and Aaron and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. It wasn't a human king. Samuel's not going down without a fight. One last warning. One last witness. Verse 7. Now, therefore, stand still that I may reason with you. Samuel, I'm sorry, they are beyond the point of reason. They've made up their minds. They know what they want using their logic, their desires. But it gets recorded. Stand still that I may reason with you before the Eternal concerning all the righteous acts of the Eternal, which he did, no human king, your divine king, which he did to you and your fathers. When Jacob had gone into Egypt and your fathers cried out to the Eternal, then the Eternal sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. And when they forgot the Eternal, their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab. So they were surrounded by enemies on the east and the west. Philistines on the west, Moab on the east. You didn't have any king to get you out of that scrape. God did. They cried out to the Eternal, and they said, we have sinned because we have forsaken the Eternal and served the Baals and Ashtoreths. But now deliver us from the hand of our enemies, and we will serve you. And the Eternal sent Jerubbabel and Bedan and Jephthah, a series of God-appointed judges, to lead them. No king. Always got them out of the trouble that they'd gotten themselves into. And Samuel. And delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side. And you dwelt in safety. And when you saw Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, come against you, you said to me, no, but a king. Human reasoning is often just so illogical. The point is, no king got you out of your previous crises, why would you think you need a king to get you out of this one? It's always been God who got you out of your crises. But they quit thinking like God at all. No, we need a human king. So at this crisis, they demanded, and that was the immediate run-up to this, and you demanded a king. A king shall reign over us when the Eternal your God was your king. Now there it is in black and white. God was your king. You don't need a human king. Verse 13. Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen. You demanded one. God chose him, but you demanded that you have a human king. And whom you have desired. Take note, the Eternal has set a king over you. If you fear the Eternal and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Eternal your God. It's plan B. It's not near as good as plan A. But God says, I'm merciful. I'm patient. The bitterness that you will suffer from a very bad decision won't be quite as bad as it otherwise would be because I'll work with you. Verse 15, however, if you do not obey the voice of the Eternal, but rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, then the hand of the Eternal will be against you as it was against your fathers. Now therefore stand and see this great thing which the Eternal will do before your eyes. There was a miracle associated with this last witness. Is not today the wheat harvest? I will call to the Eternal, and he will send thunder and rain that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great. A last testimony against them of what a bad decision they have made, which you have done in the sight of the Eternal in asking a king for yourselves. So Samuel called to the Eternal, and the Eternal sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Eternal and Samuel. I mean, the implication is this is a late storm that might have damaged a lot of their harvest. Verse 19, and all the people said to Samuel, pray to you for your servants to the Eternal your God. See, it's not our God anymore. Samuel is your God. Could you go to bat for us with your God that he would go easy on us? That we may not die. That we have added to all our sins the evil of asking a king for ourselves. Well, it sounds like they're repenting. But they're not repenting to the point where they're willing to change their mind. They still want the king. Well, anyway, so Samuel in verse 20 said to the people, don't fear. You have done all this wickedness. Yet do not turn aside from following the Eternal, but serve the Eternal with all your heart. And do not turn aside, for then you would go after empty things and so on. For verse 22, this is God's nature. Even though he's very displeased with them and they've rejected him, he will not totally reject them. He'll take away some of their blessings, but not all of them. The Eternal, verse 22, will not forsake his people. And you can read the rest of it. All right, so now we go to 2 Samuel. We're going to fast forward about 40 years. We fast forwarded 400 years from, let's say, Moses to Saul. So now Saul is their king, and he reigns for 40 years. And now it's time for Saul to have a successor. Well, God has rejected Saul, and God has rejected Saul's lineage. And God is going to choose a new man, a new family, a new tribe. Of course, that's David. But that transition from King Saul to King David, it was not short, it was not smooth, and it was not bloodless. It was complicated, it was rough, and it was time-consuming. It wasn't a snap of the finger. Saul dies and David takes over. It didn't work that way. So let's read some of that. This is, again, all background to Adonijah. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 2. So Saul's time has come to an end. Now he has a son named Ishbosheth. Human reasoning, human logic would say Ishbosheth is the new king. He's Saul's oldest surviving son. He'll be the second king. He thought he had that on his side. Just about everybody did. God has other thoughts. God's thoughts are not their thoughts. 2 Samuel chapter 2 will begin in verse 1. It came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. Now, this is the story of Saul's death. And a man once thinking David would be happy to have Saul removed. And I think most of us can go through that on our own. David showed respect to King Saul, even though God had rejected him. And so David caused this man to be killed, who bragged about being the one who killed Saul. That's not the way David thought. The transition from Saul being the first human king was not short, it was not easy, it was not smooth. Chapter 3, you can read the rest of that one. This is how it was. Not easy, not smooth, and not short. Chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, there was a long war between the house of Saul, I mean even after his death, and the house of David. But in this protracted transition, David and his forces grew steadily stronger, and Saul's family and their forces grew steadily weaker. That's a summary of it all. There was a long war, conflict, between the house of Saul and the house of David. David grew stronger and stronger. The house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And we'll get right in the middle of some of the details of that long protracted battle. But it's now time to turn our attention from Saul and from Samuel to David. God had rejected Saul and his lineage, and had now chosen David and his lineage. But again, there is a spiritual backdrop, some very important principles. And for most of that, I want to take you to the book of Proverbs, just a few verses in the book of Proverbs that is some important background spiritual material as our attention now turns to David and eventually to Adonijah. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs 3. Many of you have this memorized. It's quoted in the New Testament. It not only applies to physical child-rearing, but on the spiritual realm as we're children of God. Proverbs 3 and verse 12. Whom the Eternal loves, he corrects. Again, human reasoning, especially in our modern Dr. Spock world, doesn't think that way. They think it's child abuse or parent hatred toward their children to in any way correct them, thwart their will when their will is foolishness. But that's just the opposite of what God says. God says, ones he loves, he corrects. And he says, that should be the way it is in the human realm, just as a father, the son in whom he delights. It's not hatred toward children to correct them. Now, we're not talking about child abuse or beating. We're talking about balanced discipline. A child who grows up without any kind of balanced discipline does not have a parent or parents who love them, according to God's judgment. Now, according to Dr. Spock and maybe human psychologists and misled people, maybe so. But that's the mind of man, not the mind of God. This is very clear. Just as a father, the son in whom he delights will also correct the child he loves. Let's go to chapter 13 of Proverbs. We'll stay here in Proverbs and just look at a few verses. This will apply to David, and it'll indirectly apply to Adonijah. Proverbs 13 and verse 24. He who spares his rod hates his son. Now again, we don't want a picture in our mind of a beating to the point of welts and injuries and bruising. We're talking about balanced, moderate, and yet some kind of discipline. He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. I mean, that could just not be any clearer. That's the mind of God on display, regardless of what the mind of man comes up with. It's balanced. It's not any kind of thing that would lead to injury or death, but it is balanced, and it is out of love, not out of hatred. We go to Proverbs 19 and verse 18. This isn't just a proverb stating something, it's actually a command. Chasten, that's the imperative voice, chasten, you know, correct. Sometimes thwart their will, little children's will, because their will may be foolishness. It might be something that's going to get them hurt or killed. So we have to thwart their will because there's folly involved and something that could hurt them. Chasten your son while there is hope. And look at the last part of verse 18 there. Proverbs 19:18. Do not set your heart on his destruction. There's a modern translation that I think that really gives us what that's saying. The first part says, discipline, chasten, thwart their will if it's foolishness or it's something that's going to hurt them. The second part says, because if you don't, you're actually leading to their own self-destruction. And in the Good News Bible, this is a modern translation or paraphrase, the way they state it, I think, really hits the nail on the head. If you don't thwart their will or chasten them, you are helping them destroy themselves. Now, that's God's judgment. Again, regardless of what any person or group of people think, that's God's judgment. Proverbs 22, in this case, verse 15. Why must a young child or even a growing child, why must their will or their decision sometimes be thwarted or overruled or prevented? Because they're foolish. Where'd that come from? Their own heart. God says foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. No human baby is born with godly wisdom. Really, I would say no human baby is born with any kind of wisdom. There's plenty of capacity for folly and self-destruction in a human heart. And loving parents will discipline, guide, teach. It's more than punishment. There's teaching. It's a whole way of parenting. As I said, God is hard on the heroes. You know who did not do any of this with regard to his son Adonijah? David. We're going to see that. But foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it from him, far from him. If you go back to verse 6 of that same verse, train up a child. Now, that's more than spanking. It's more than corporal punishment. It's teaching. It's spending time. It's conveying wisdom, showing the folly, and then preventing the things that a child would want to do that would get them really hurt. Now, even God sometimes lets children learn from their mistakes. We've seen that. There would be that aspect of it. Sometimes a parent will let a child play out their folly if they know that in the end a good lesson could be learned. It's a balanced approach. But train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. Are there never any exceptions to that? Is it never the case? I mean, is that an ironclad guarantee? Well, if you put all the scriptures together, what that is describing is by far the majority of the cases. If a parent out of love does teach and guide and mold and is patient with their child, way more than not, on balance, good results. But sometimes, because they're free moral agents, the children of even the most righteous and conscientious parents will make mistakes and will choose a wrong way of life. That the rest of the Bible, when you put it together with that, shows that. One more, chapter 29 of verse 17. But way more often than not, a godly and wise parent who conscientiously works with their children in the ways being described here will see good fruits in their children when they are older. Way more often than not. Proverbs 29 and verse 17. Again, this is the imperative voice. This isn't just a suggestion. This isn't a commandment. Correct your son, and he will give you rest. Yes, he will give delight to your soul. Now, that's a good segue into really the topic at hand, Adonijah, the son of David. It turns out, sadly enough, that David never did this. And I'm not just imagining it. The Bible tells us David did not do that. He did not obey that command of Proverbs 29:17 with regard to Adonijah and the other ones we saw. And it doesn't look like he obeyed that command with most of his sons. He was a great man of God. He will be in the first resurrection, but this was one of his great failings. Well, I'm busy. I'm the king. You're not too busy to obey God when it comes to these important matters, David. And I'm sure by the end of his life he repented of this. Let's look for the proof of what I just said in 1 Kings. We've dived down right into the narrative of Adonijah. And let's look at 1 Kings chapter 1. This is 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5, and we actually read about Adonijah. David had many wives. He violated that principle that was laid out clear back through Moses. One of his wives was named Haggith. Verse 5 of 1 Kings 1. Adonijah, the son of Haggith, that's the mother, the father is David, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. Now we've looked at a lot of background of why they have kings in the first place, but now we're in that era where they have human kings, and he wanted to be the next one. His father David was the king, and he wants to be the next one. I will be king. And he says it out of pride and self-exaltation. We don't usually look to Saul for a good example, but in this case, early on, this does not describe Saul, but it does describe Adonijah. I'll be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen. Saul was hiding among the chariots. This man is preparing chariots to take the kingship by force. Big difference. Self-exaltation. Pride. 50 men to run before him. Now look at verse 6. His father, who was that again? David. Had not rebuked him at any time. I mean, that's not the language of, well, he was a pretty good parent. He got it right most of the time. And that sounds like he never worked with Adonijah as a loving father would, correcting him, thwarting his will when it was foolishness, molding his character. That sounds like he never did. His father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, why have you done so? Wait a minute, Adonijah, little Adonijah. Maybe when he's 3, maybe when he's 7, maybe when he's 12. What are you doing? That's wrong. I'm not going to let you do that. This language says David never did that. Adonijah had total free reign. And you know what? It made it even worse. He was one of the best looking men in Israel. Who better to be a king than somebody as handsome as me? Read the next words. He was very good looking. I should be the king. And his mother had borne him after Absalom. 2 brothers with the same mother, the same father, but in this case the same mother. Adonijah and Absalom, and they both tried to overthrow their father. The story of Absalom is more well known, but we're going to get into Adonijah and his attempt. At this point, let's look at that handout, because there's another dimension to this whole story of Adonijah. We're going to read about a lot of names. Remember I told you the transition from Saul to David and then from David to Solomon, none of them were quick, easy, bloodless. This handout I've titled The Warring and Related Generals of Saul and David. You might remember in the United States a few years ago we had a TV show called All in the Family. Well, that really applies to these two sides of the paper. Saul and his family, David and his family. They kept it all in the family. We'll read about Saul and his generals, and sometimes if we haven't got this background, we won't realize they were all related. They were all related to Saul. And we'll read about David and his great generals and his mighty warriors and his advisors. And without this background, it might go over our head, they were all related. They were all part of David's family. So let's look at it. On the left side of the paper, we have Saul, the first human king of Israel. Now, there's a man named Jael. We'll just start the story there. Probably none of us have ever heard of Jael, but Jael was the father of 2 sons. One was named Kish, and I commented on Kish earlier, and the other was named Ner. So they're brothers. Kish and Ner are brothers, the sons of a man named Jael. Well, look at Kish's son, or at least one of them, Saul. Look at Ner's son, Abner. Abner was a great mighty warrior in Israel. And he tended to side with the family of Saul in this difficult transition period between Saul and David. Here was a great warrior, Abner. Well, it turns out he's Saul's cousin. The general of Saul's army is Saul's cousin. Now, Saul, when he leaves the scene, he has a surviving son named Ish-bosheth. And Abner, in trying to win the kingship for Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, Abner, General Abner, supported Ish-bosheth. Well, it's not surprising. He's Ish-bosheth's first cousin once removed. Just look at the family line. They're keeping it all in the family. What? You wouldn't expect Abner to support David. Abner's tied in with Saul's family. Now let's go to the other side of the page. We got David. Have you ever heard of Zeruiah? We know of David that David had brothers, because when Samuel was sent by God to Jesse's home to anoint one of Jesse's sons to be the next king of Israel to follow Saul, we read about his brothers. Jesse, using human reason, thought, well, my oldest son, my tallest son, my best-looking son, that's the one God will choose. Well, it wasn't. But we read about those brothers. We might not even have been aware that David had sisters. Well, he did. And one of them is named Zeruiah. Let's go to 1 Chronicles. David had at least one sister. Probably two. But let's look at 1 Chronicles chapter 2. Now, you know, if you're just reading without knowing what you're looking for, this is maybe some sleep-inducing material here. I mean, just one name after another, just a bunch of names. But maybe this will help the story of Adonijah, when we get to it, live a little bit more. All right, so we have the families of Israel is what 1 Chronicles 2 is talked about. There's 12 sons. There was also Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. Let's look at verse 3. The sons of Judah were Onan, and Shelah. Now, most of us are at least vaguely familiar with two of those three names. We read about them in the book of Genesis. Sons of Judah. We're narrowing it down from 12 tribes to one tribe to kings. You've got to go through Judah to get there, at least if it's King David. Well, it says, these three were born to him by the daughter of Shua the Canaanitess. The firstborn of Judah was wicked in the sight of the Eternal, and he killed him. God killed this man because of his wickedness and his refusal to cooperate in God's purpose and plan. Verse 4 talks about Tamar, his daughter-in-law, bore him Perez and Zerah. Old-timers are very familiar with those names, the two lines of Judah, the Perez line and the Perez line. And for a while they were separated and they were reunited. Eventually that leads to Christ. So those are somewhat familiar names. But let's skip down a little bit. We get into material that takes us to the book of Ruth. Verse 11, somebody named Nahshon begat Salma, and Salma begat Boaz. Boaz, that's from the book of Ruth. It sure is. Boaz. Boaz begot Obed, and Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begat a bunch of boys, one of whom was David. Jesse begat Eliab, his firstborn, using human reason, human desires. Jesse thought that would be the king, that God would have surely sent Samuel to anoint his oldest son, Eliab, but he didn't. That's human reasoning. Abinadab the second, Shimeah the third, Nathanael the fourth, Radai the fifth, Ozem the sixth, and David, kind of like an afterthought, the seventh, the runt. And yet that's the one. But then look at the next verse. So those are the seven boys, the brothers, and it says their sisters. Whose sisters? The sons of Jesse had sisters. That would mean David had sisters. Their sisters were Zeruiah, she's on the handout, and Abigail. And then it says the sons of Zeruiah were three, Abishai, Joab, and Azahel. All right, we go back to the handout. So we see David. Now we see his sister, and it might have been a half-sister. The mother of David is not mentioned, and the mother of Zeruiah is not mentioned. In each case, it's the father. Some of the scholars that have gone into this in a lot of detail have concluded it might be at least 50-50 probable that Zeruiah had a mother who became a widow, and then the widow of this unnamed person married Jesse, and that's where Zeruiah was an offspring. So David might have been a half-brother to Zeruiah, maybe a step. There might have been different parents involved, with Jesse being the common element. But at least he was a half-sister. It says he was a sister. I mean, if you just take it literally, it was a full-blooded sister. But with some of the other history, it might have been a half-sister. Well, anyway, we just saw that this Zeruiah had three sons, Azahel, Joab, and Abishai, who are all brothers, obviously. If they're the sons of the same woman, they're brothers. So those, Joab, we know about Joab. He was another great warrior, another great general of David. Well, he was David's nephew. Worst case, he was a half-nephew. It's all in the family. So Saul is surrounding himself and his son Ish-bosheth are surrounding themselves with military advisors, generals, other advisors, keeping it in the family. They're all related. Same on David's side. Two names there I've highlighted, Abner and Joab. Abner is a great warrior and a general on Saul's side of the page. Joab is a great warrior and general on David's side of the page. You know, sooner or later, when I already told you this transition is going to be messy, there's going to be some killing involved. Well, there was some killing involved. Let's go to 2 Samuel and see. Again, this all leads us to our point, but I think it'll make our point when we get there to Adonijah more understandable. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 2. Now, Saul has died. We already saw that Ish-bosheth, his son, to all human knowledge, would be the new king of Israel. God has other plans. He sends Samuel secretly to Jesse, anoints David, but David doesn't immediately become king over all 12 tribes. It's a long, protracted mess. So we pick it up in 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 4. The men of Judah came and they anointed David. Wait a minute, I thought there were 12 tribes in Israel. Well, there are. How many acknowledged God's choice to succeed Saul being David? One, his own tribe, Judah. The rest of the tribes are following Ish-bosheth and his great general Abner. Initially, David is only king over one tribe, Judah, his own family. The men of Judah came and there they anointed David, king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who buried Saul. And that's a kind of a side story. So verse 8, but Abner, first cousin once removed to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, Abner, maybe the real power behind the throne. Ish-bosheth doesn't have much in the way of experience or fighting. The real kingmaker over on the left side of the page is Abner, General Abner, Saul's cousin. It says, Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Manahem, and he made him king. Who's the real power? Abner. Who's the real power to fight against David? Abner. Ish-bosheth is kind of a figurehead. Ish-bosheth, verse 10, Saul's son was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. This doesn't last long, but it's more than a week, and it's certainly more than a day. Only the house of Judah followed David, so Ish-bosheth is king over all the other tribes, and only Judah is following David. Now, verse 12, Abner, this great kingmaker, the power over the majority of the nation, the son of Ner and the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, okay, he's over on David's side of the page. He's the great general and the relative, the nephew of David. So the two great generals, Abner, Israel, Joab, Judah, and their armies, they come together to this place called Gibeon. And verse 13, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. So far, no bloodshed. Now, there's this bizarre proposal that Abner proposes. They sat down, one on the one side of the pool, maybe a lake, and the other on the other side of the pool. The armies are right there, and their generals. And the future of the monarchy is right being determined. And Abner says, let's have a tug of war. I say a tug of war. Maybe. Verse 14. Abner said to Joab, let the young men now arise and compete before us. It doesn't start out being a pitched battle between two armies. 12 men from one army and 12 men from another army. I almost envision a tug of war. Whoever wins, their guy gets to be king. It started out based on that somewhat bizarre proposal from Abner. Now, it quickly escalated. It didn't stay peaceful very long, but that's how it started. And so Joab said, fine, my guys are stronger than your guys anyway. They'll win. So let them arise. So verse 15, they arose and went over by number, 12 from Benjamin and 12 of the followers of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. And each, now I say it escalated very quickly from a tug of war or Olympic games or wrestling matches. It escalated very quickly to wrestling matches with daggers. But there's just 24 contestants. Each one grasped his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. Got out of hand very quickly. Now it's wrestling with daggers. So they fell down together. Therefore that place was called the Field of Sharp Swords, which is in Gibeon. There was a very fierce battle that day. Now it escalates that after the wrestling and the stabbing, there's a pitched battle between the two armies, one led by Abner and one led by Joab. It was a fierce battle that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And we're left to speculate, were angels or God behind the scenes seeing to it that that happened? Because God was going to see to it that Ish-bosheth was not the king, that David was, and that his side of the page would eventually win. Well, here it begins. His side of the contest wins, and then his side of the battle begins to win. We don't even see David on the scene here. We see the two generals, Abner and Joab. One's a relative of Ish-bosheth, and one's a relative of David. Now, these three sons of Zeruiah, who are the nephews or the half-nephews of David, Joab we know, he's kind of the great general. There's another one named Asahel. And there's something very unusual about Asahel. If he was in the Olympic Games, he would win the sprints and the marathon. He was a runner like nobody alive today. Nobody could run like this man. Let's read a description of that. Verse 18, the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Azahel. And Azahel was as fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. Now, have you ever seen anybody, could Usain Bolt win a race against a gazelle? I don't think so. This man was, is that hyperbole? Well, it says what it says. I don't think it's hyperbole based on what follows. I think this man had an ability that no human today has. And Asahel was as fleet as a gazelle. So Asahel pursued Abner. Now you got the picture? Once this thing escalated to a battle, Joab and his warriors defeated Abner and his warriors. And Abner and his warriors start to flee the scene of the battle. And Abner is no doubt in a chariot being pulled by horses. Horses can also run pretty fast. And guess who runs him down in his horse-drawn chariot? Asahel, David's nephew. Let's read it. Asahel pursued Abner, and in going he did not turn to the right hand or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Are you Asahel?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and lay hold on one of the other young men." So you got a picture of him saying, "Boy, don't mess with me. I'm an experienced general. If you want to run down or tackle somebody your own age, and you want to take his sword away from him and take it back as a trophy, do that, but don't mess with me." That's what Abner is telling Asahel. But Asahel's not listening. "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and lay hold on one of the young men and take his armor for yourself," you know, as a trophy. Asahel would not turn aside from following. So Abner said to him again, he's going to warn him a second time, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? If you don't stop this, I'm going to kill you. How then could I face your brother Joab?" He wasn't really afraid of Asahel, but he had some respect for Joab, the great general on the other side of the page. Abner knew who his enemy really was. It was Joab. However, he refused. Asahel, he kept, and he was gaining on him. Therefore, Abner, now at this point, we would have to say this is self-defense. This is fair. He gave him two warnings. At this point, Abner struck him in the stomach with the blunt end of his spear. Now, you've got to imagine the force behind that. It wasn't the sharp end. It was the blunt end. And there was such force that it came out Asahel's back. Kind of gory to think about. The blunt end of his spear, so that the spear came out of his back. Well, he drops dead. so that he fell down there and died on the spot. So it was that many came to the place where Azazel fell down and died and stood still. Well, now Abner's gone and done it. So you see this diagonal line. Abner kills Azazel. And now he's going to have an enemy in the name, by the name of Joab the rest of his life. And it won't be long. He won't have any life. Joab is going to take revenge because Abner killed his brother, his little brother. One family, another family, all in a family. Let's go to chapter 3 and we see the revenge. This is the second killing on my handout for you. Chapter 3, verse 22. Now there's some details I'm skipping over here that you can read it yourself. Abner is not only a great warrior and a great general, but he's also pretty smart. We already read this summary verse. Over time, David kept getting stronger, his family, his army. Ishbosheth just kept getting, and Abner, weaker. Abner finally says, I'm on the losing team. So what does he do? He decides to go over and join with David. And he goes and has a meeting with David. And David hears him out. Abner says, okay, I'm going to quit fighting you. I'll bring the army over on your side, and you'll be the king over all the armies and all the tribes. And then he leaves and lets David think about it. At the time this meeting takes place, Joab is not there. Joab is David's chief military advisor, but he's not there. He comes back and he hears that David has had a meeting with Abner, the enemy. We come to verse 22, and Joab is angry. Now you can only imagine what's going through Joab's mind. Wait a minute. Abner's going to become your new friend. Maybe he's going to become your new chief general. Maybe he's going to displace me. Plus, he killed my brother. So verse 22, at that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. Abner has just left, and now here comes Joab. But Abner was not with David in Hebron. He had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. Verse 23, when Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, you know, Abner, the son of Ner, came. Do you know that David just met Abner while you were gone, Joab? Joab throws a fit. And look at the way he talks to David, who should be his superior. Does familiarity ever breed contempt in a family? Look at the way. Nobody talks to David like this. Well, if he's your half-nephew, he might. And that's exactly what we see. If we didn't realize that this was a relative, that he could talk this way, we might be very shocked at what we see here. Verse 24, Joab came to the king. Well, nobody talks to the king like this. What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away? You had him. You should have killed him. He's the enemy. What are you thinking? Very disrespectful. Very in David's... Well, he's his nephew. Maybe familiarity has bred some contempt. Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you. He's a spy. He was just coming to see how we're organized over here so he can attack us. To know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you're doing. And when Joab had gone from David's presence, so he storms out. He chews his own king out, translate his own relative, and then in a rage he leaves. And he's going to go take care of the situation because it's pretty clear to him David's not. When Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner. There's subterfuge, there's deceit here. Who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know about it. Joab's doing all this on his own. Now, when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate. Oh, everything's great. Have a party. I understand you had a meeting with my king, David, and I guess you're coming over to our side. Isn't that great? Hey, can I have a word with you out here all by myself? He takes him out and he kills him. Joab kills Abner in cold blood. Joab took him aside to the gate to speak with him privately, and there he stabbed him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Azazel, his brother. David finds out about this, and he's very unhappy. Well, why doesn't he do something about it? Why doesn't he have Joab killed? Well, sometimes blood's thicker than water. He's his nephew. He's his sister's son. When David heard about it, he said, my kingdom and I are guiltless before the eternal forever for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. He mourns murder in cold blood of basically an innocent man, Abner. Yes, he was the enemy, but he didn't die like a soldier. He died by deceit and murder. Well, the last part of this little bit of story, Joab doesn't get away with it, really, in the long run. In the lower right-hand part of the handout, we'll see Joab later defected to Adonijah. So we're all leading all these details back to Adonijah, the son of David. When David's about to die, there's another messy transition. Who's going to succeed David? Not who's going to succeed Saul, who's going to succeed David? Joab throws his fortunes with Adonijah, even though God had made it very clear to David that it was to be Solomon. Absalom had tried this earlier and had died, overthrowing his father David. And now his full-blooded brother Adonijah tries the same, and Joab is in there with him. Joab's ready to move on from David, and he's certainly ready to move on from Solomon. So he defects to Adonijah. Now there's a typo, my fault there. It says 2 Kings chapter 2. That should read 1 Kings. They're at the very bottom of that. So if you want to change that, if it helps. But it's 1 Kings chapter 2, and we'll see that part. As I say on the handout there, Joab defected to Adonijah and was killed at Solomon's orders. And he dies really for two reasons, that he betrayed David at the end of David's life, and kind of looking back a few years, he had killed Abner in cold blood, unjustly. So we go to 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 5. At Gibeon, this is David talking. David's about to die. God has told him, your son Solomon will succeed you. This is David talking. At Gibeon, the Eternal appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask, what shall I give you? I'm in the wrong chapter. Chapter 2. I was reading chapter 3, sorry. 1 Kings 2, verse 5. Here's David. Moreover, you know also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, my sister, did to me, and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, we just read about, where he killed Abner in cold blood without David's knowledge, the son of Ner, and Amasa. Now, that's a whole other story I didn't go into. Joab is triply guilty. At the end, he betrays David. Earlier, he had killed two great men in cold blood without David's permission. And he shed the blood of war in peacetime, and he put the blood of war on his belt that was around his waist and on his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore, David, about to die, tells Solomon, do the right thing. You take care of Joab. Don't let him go down to the grave in peace. It was set a wrong example. Do according to your wisdom. Do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. Verse 28, skip forward a few verses. Then news came to Joab. Joab now realizes he's a marked man, that Solomon has ordered his death. Joab had defected to Adonijah right at the end of David's life, although he had not defected to Absalom. Adonijah's older brother had also tried to overthrow his father, and Joab had been faithful to David on that occasion, but not on this one. So Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Eternal and took hold of the horns of the altar. That was kind of the official safe space. If you could make it to the tabernacle, to the altar, and grab, you were supposed to be immune from capital punishment in normal times. These are not normal times. Verse 29, King Solomon was told, Joab has fled to the tabernacle of the Eternal, and there he is by the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah. Now that's his official executioner. Must have been a fearsome man. Anybody needed to be killed, they sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go, strike him down, kill Joab. So Benaiah went to the tabernacle of the Eternal and said to him, thus says the king, come out. Joab, I know you're in there. Come out here so I can kill you. Well, Joab is not willing to participate. He said, no, I'll die here. He doesn't think Benaiah will go in to the tabernacle and kill him right there. So Benaiah goes back to Solomon and says he won't come out. Solomon says, all right, go in. If he wants to die at the altar, let him die at the altar. Go kill him there. These are not normal times. Verse 31, the king, Solomon, said to him, do as he has said, strike him down and bury him, that you may take away from me and from the house of my father innocent blood which Joab shed. So the Eternal will return his blood on his own head because he struck down two men more righteous and better than he, one of whom was Abner, and killed them with the sword. Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of the army of Israel, and this other man, Amasa, the son of Jether, the commander of the army of Judah, though my father David did not know it. Joab was loyal to David most of his life, but at the end he defected to Adonijah, as Adonijah is trying to thwart God's will, and that will would be that Solomon would be his successor. Now, believe it or not, that was the introduction to the sermon. This is going to be a two-part sermon. I think that's all you can take for today, so we'll hope to pick it up next time.